I thought I'd talk to you this morning on something a little different to what I've worked a lot in over the past few years, which is recombination. I'm going to talk to you about much more recent work I've been doing in the last couple of years on a different topic, which is understanding human admixture and finding new ways to do association mapping to find genes and mutations that affect diseases and human disease in admixed populations specifically. And I thought I'd begin by putting up a picture of Barack Obama, partly because it's just an excuse to show his face and partly because he's going to be a big distraction for you guys from this talk, I think. But also he's a nice example of an admixed individual, of course. And so I'll begin by defining what... It's the first time he's... Okay, so I'll define what I mean by admixture, firstly. So what I think of as an admixture event is an event where we have two populations, and these two populations, they must share a common ancestor. They're from the same species, they share a common ancestor far enough back in time, but they've been separated for some long period, and that's enabled them to become, to some degree, genetically differentiated, so they have different allele and haplotype frequencies from each other, and these guys are denoted by red and yellow. And at some point in time, through a migration event or a range expansion or something, those populations come together and they begin genetically mixing. And so when we have these mixing events in the first generation, what you see is individuals with one chromosome from the first population and the other chromosome from the other population. And so, to push the Barack Obama theme a little bit further, I guess that's Barack Obama because he's got one of his chromosomes from Kenya and one from European descent. And so then what happens is that those chromosomes continue to mix in subsequent generations. And over subsequent generations, what happens is that they begin to recombine together. And so instead of seeing entire chromosomes that are red or yellow, your genome becomes a mosaic of these different ancestries. So you have these yellow and red chunks, as we see down here. And as we sort of follow for more and more generations since the admixture event, more and more recombination happens, and those chunks get smaller and smaller. And that's going to be an important idea in the talk, because it means we can get some sense of a time since this admixture event by looking at how big these chunks are in the genome. So, in principle, we could learn about admixture just by trying to look at these chunk distribution along the genome. And the problem that we're going to have to overcome, and it's sort of the focus of the methods development I'm going to talk to you about, is that unfortunately, we don't get to see these chunks. All we get to see is some genetic variation data from these individuals, and we have to try and use that data to learn about these underlying chunks. So that's what makes the problem interesting and difficult. Okay, so today I'm going to concentrate on humans, although some of the methods could be applied to other species as well. And it's thought, you know, there's very good evidence that lots of different human populations have been affected by historical admixture events. And so African Americans, obviously, but also Native Americans have received DNA from Europeans since the European colonization. And populations around the world, such as Melanesians, who are thought to have been influenced by multiple waves of immigration from East Asia. And you could go on and on. And what I'm going to sort of try and talk about is some methods to try and understand how admixture events like this have left traces in genetic variation data, and how we can go and use some genetic variation data to learn about these events, when they happened, and who contributed to them directly. So we go sort of to the point of view of just using the genetic data to try and learn something about human history, or the events that have shaped our genomes. So that's the first half of the talk, is sort of trying to learn about historical events. And the second half of the talk I'm going to sort of ask and give some examples of how we can use admixed populations to try and identify disease genes in human populations. Okay, so you might sort of say, well, why do we care about admixture at all? Well, the first reason is, you know, we're people, we like to learn stories about ourselves, and some of us are interested in learning about our history. And there's already a lot of information about human history that we can glean from things like linguistics, written records, and archaeology. But it seems that genetic data must be another powerful tool, and I'll explain why it's been sort of under-tapped and it's difficult to, but possible to find information from it. There are other reasons that are equally important. So firstly, if we see that populations have been mixing with one another, that has an effect on how selective alleles can evolve. So for example, if you have an allele that evolves in one population, then it admixes with another, it can introduce that allele to that group. And Graham's going to talk a lot about selection tomorrow, so in some ways this should lead into his discussion, his talk. And finally, there's a sort of really applied purpose, which is that as we'll see, if we can identify these admixture chunks in the genome, we can empower and allow more powerful disease mapping than would otherwise be possible. Okay, so what do we actually need to know? Well, in order to sort of gain all these advantages, we want to know what admixture events happened, but as precisely as possible, we want to know which particular populations were involved and when did it happen. And that's part one of the talk, and it's joint work with Daniel Felucian, who's now in Cork in Ireland, and Garrett, who's in Oxford. So, okay. And what we've been working on is a very, very powerful new data set, which is a new set of worldwide variation data for the Human Genome Diversity Panel. And in case some of you are not familiar with what that data is, it's data drawn from 52 populations that are in some sense worldwide. They certainly cover all of the major continental groups apart from Australia. And here's their locations on the globe. So you see, so things that are going to be important for this talk, notice that coverage is very good in some areas and pretty patchy or almost non-existent in others.
HapMap 3 or is it something different?
It's different from HapMap 3. So HapMap 3 covers a much smaller set of populations, actually. And also the data's not yet publicly available, I think.
It's
supposed to go out tomorrow. Okay. So it's at least a day late. But I think that this has a wider genome-wide coverage than HapMap 3. On the other hand, it has fewer individuals in some populations. Okay, so there's 52 populations, and there are a variable number of individuals typed from each population, but in total, there are about just under 1,000 unrelated individuals that you have data for. And they've been typed at about 650,000 SNP loci, i.e. positions that vary in the human genome, and those loci are spread across the entire genome. So we really have a really impressive map of genetic variation in these populations. And what we're going to concentrate on finding out is which of these groups are admixed and when and how. Okay, so there have already been about two, you know, really detailed analyses of these genome-wide data sets published in Science and Nature this year. And they already tell us, I'm just going to concentrate on what they can tell us about admixture. They already tell us something about the process of admixture in those populations. And so, for example, this is a figure from, I think, Lee et al. There are similar figures in the other paper as well. That shows inference from the program structure, which some of you may be familiar with, for all of these 52 groups along the x-axis there. And if you're not familiar with structure, just think of it as a way of inferring a small number of sort of progenitor populations, if you like, these different colors that best explain all the variation in the data in terms of allele frequencies. And what this plot shows is how each of these 52 populations is made up of a mixture of those progenitor populations, if you like. So that's a very loose and somewhat inaccurate description of the very sophisticated software package. But what you can see from that analysis is that, firstly, there are sort of continental patterns, so that Africa seemed to be in one group, Europe largely in another, East Asia in a third, and Central and South Asia in a fourth. However, there are a number of populations that seem to be, in some sense, or they look like mixtures of the other groups. And so, for example, we see what looks like African DNA in the Mozambique population, also over here. And we see these populations here, the Hazara and the Uyghur, that seem a mixture of East Asian and Central Asian and some European DNA.
Is this using haplotypes inferred from genotypes?
So I think this analysis is using allele frequencies only. So the idea is that you have, what you want to do is you have the allele frequencies in different populations. So you have these, in this case, it's fixed in advance that you have six or seven colors. And for each of those colors, you want a sort of a vector of allele frequencies. So you try and infer a vector of allele frequencies, and then you fit each of the individuals in your data set as a best mixture of those allele frequencies. And so to capture the majority of the variation in the data, and then the complexity is that the inference procedure also infers the seven population frequencies as well. So you start with a random start point, and then you iterate the procedure to try and maximize the likelihood.
It's like a clustering analysis on the frequency matrix, right?
It's so you can do similar things with a clustering analysis. Or you can do principal components analyses, and they'll give somewhat similar results, but in this case, it's actually a model-based MCMC procedure.
The HTTP data, when they were sampling these populations, do you know, did they, like I would expect, for example, if you choose Maya, people who describe themselves as Maya somehow have more European ancestry than others. Is the sampling sort of biased to people who,
So the short answer is I know nothing about the sampling procedure.
Okay.
I do think that the data was sampled by many different people worldwide, so there are likely to be some differences in that sampling procedure.
Yeah.
They didn't do. Yeah, so they've deliberately tried to, for example, sample a wide range of different ethnic groups in China. They've tried to find places where those ethnic groups are well represented. And you know, as we'll see, we tend to find that people are well identified with the groups they're supposed to belong to. That's what I could say. Okay, so we have this picture that suggests that some or lots of these populations are in some way mixtures of some of the others. But from this analysis, what we can't learn is really strong details of, you know, exactly who contributed this sub-Saharan African DNA to these groups. You know, where was it from? And we can't also tell at what time that contribution happened. And those are the two gaps that we're looking to fill. And the idea is that we've got such fine scale, you know, we've got a very sort of precise description of the DNA of all these people, and that data should be very rich in information. So even though the signals that we're looking for are very weak, because many human populations are genetically quite similar to one another, we're going to try and just use the fact that we've got a very big stick, i.e. lots and lots of data, to learn something. hit with a big stick. Okay. And the basis of a big stick that we're going to try and hit it with is the Lee and Stevens model that was published in 2003 and has been really, really influential in the study of genetic variation. And so I'll start by saying this is a hidden Markov model that describes the structure of genetic variation in a population. And why do we use the Lee and Stevens model? Well, the reason that we use it is that it's a way of sort of modeling and accounting for short-range association between genetic types across different individuals. And what it does is it says that, suppose that we have an individual here, and we've genetically, so this is a haplotype, and we've worked out the genetic type along this haplotype with the two alleles shown in blue and white in this picture, so that's the data we've got. Then what we do is we model that haplotype as being constructed from a set of other haplotypes we've looked at, and these are the red haplotypes, and we model it as a mosaic of those other haplotypes. And so pictorially, you can kind of draw a picture like this. So it says this new haplotype is constructed, you know, the first two sites are copied from this individual, and then if we're thinking about historical events, then we switch to another individual, we can think of that as a recombination event historically. Historical recombination event, so now we're more closely related to this individual, and we copy their type, and then we switch again, and so on. And as we move along the genome, we're almost identical to the individual segment that we copy from in most cases, although with some low probability we can have a mutation so that the type of this haplotype might be different from the one we copy from. And so that model has some features that mirror those of real data. So firstly, that the key feature being that at short range, you tend to see association between the type here and the type there, and that's reflected in the fact that you tend to copy from the same individual historically. And I won't say much about this model except to say that it's in some way motivated by based on a well-described model of evolution, which is a coalescent. Yeah.
But you have to put a typical length scale in there, isn't it? You have to put a cost for switching the individual, I guess, and this cost relates to a typical length scale on which you allow for switches. So where do you get this next
skill? Yes, so thanks for that's a good question. So as I said, these switching events, you can think of them historically as recombinations.
Right.
So the same events that cause the jumbling up of those ancestry chunks. And the idea is that because you think of them as recombinations, there's a natural way of scaling the jump rate. So firstly, I'll say that we have, from variation data, actually we have already produced fine scale estimates of recombination rates. So for every pair of these sites, we can look up our recombination map and find out the appropriate genetic distance between those sites, which is how much switching we expect to see. And then we actually have to scale those recombination rates as well by a quantity related at least to the effective population size of our population. Well, when we put this into practice, we infer that scaling factor from the data. So we say that the rates are proportional to some known quantity, and then we allow the constant of proportionality to be fit by the data.
Somewhat the length scale relates to exactly the kind of question you asked, right? How long is the admixtion event away in time? And the longer it is away, the smaller are these chunks you expect.
I see. Okay, so
Okay, so
let me say something about these chunks. So suppose that we can suppose for now that this individual is drawn from the same population as all of these. So it's a randomly mating population, and there's no underlying structure. Then we still see these changes in background because we've drawn a sample of unrelated individuals, and so in their joint history, you know, they don't tend to interact very much, but eventually they start coalescing. But before they do that, recombination events will happen. Okay, so in the ancient history that relates any sample of individuals, you'll see lots of these recombination switching events. And so this switching process is actually pretty rapid along the genome. So it typically defines segments of a genome that are tens or hundreds of thousands of bases long. So you think of these segments as tens or hundreds of thousands of bases long. And the recombination events that delineate the admixture chunks have happened more recently in history for most admixture events. So they've had to happen within the last few thousand years. And that means that those sort of red and yellow chunks are much bigger. They're millions or tens of millions of bases long. And that fact that we've got this difference between an expected rapid switching and a sort of slower rate switching is what enables us to learn about admixture. So there's a pretty good separation between this parameter and the parameter we're interested in, I think.
Do you assume anything other than that? I mean, you assume that coalescent it's neutral, the whole thing is neutral, that there's no selection wrong, and that do you insist that the coalescent times appear the way they would appear in, let's say, neutral theory? You don't assume any of that, right?
Well, we're using this model as a basis of our inference, although as I'll try and argue later that we're somewhat robust to whether this model is true or not. So in fact, this model is based on those assumptions that you describe, and it will be more appropriate in those settings. But we think that they're at least reasonably okay for human populations. You know, many useful inferences have been done using this model. But yeah, of course we have selection, and we certainly have population size changes. Okay, so what I described there was just the original model. And so what we've actually done is to extend that model to allow for the idea that we actually have information about ancestry chunks. Okay, and so actually we know a bit more than that there's some previous sample of individuals. So now suppose that this chromosome is a chromosome of interest from some population that we wonder whether it might be admixed. Well, we can model that chromosome in terms of all the other HGDP individuals that we've also sampled. And those HGDP individuals actually come with population labels. So we can color some of them red and some of them yellow. And in fact, there should be sort of 52 different sets of individuals. And we want some way to reflect the fact that this individual may have a larger contribution from one population than another. And so what we do is we extend the Lee and Stevens model to say, well, when we have these switch events, we're more likely to switch to, say, this population with probability P2 than to this population with probability P1. Okay, so we can have a parameter for each population which describes how often we copy from it. And then again, we infer a recombination rate parameter, a single parameter. And having done that, we model this chromosome again as a sort of mosaic of the other chromosomes. But this time, what we can do is we can actually paint the chromosome we're interested in. So everywhere you copy from an individual from the red population, you paint red, and places where you copy from an individual for yellow population, you paint yellow.
So you have a different P1 and P2 for every individual or for every... So it must change relative to which individual you consider. That is, that if I take an African, I'm more likely to switch with another African population than
me. Yes, so we have a different... We can have two versions. So firstly, we can fix those parameters to be the same across everyone from the same population. So we often do that, or we can, you know, the data is actually quite informative, so we can actually infer individual parameters for every person in the sample.
How do you define a population? Just on geography? Or?
Well, we define it from the labels we're given by the HGDP. So, you know, that's a mixture of where they're sampled from and...
You don't look for white chromosome haplogroups or mitochondrial haplogroups.
We don't have Y chromosome or mitochondrial, or we don't have mitochondrial or Y chromosome DNA, but we're interested in seeing, you know, we have these labels of different groups. And so we think it's sensible to use those labels. And as we'll see, those labels are a perfectly good way of delineating populations. Yeah.
Population labels, so they're somewhat sensible labels.
Yeah.
This is done in some self-consistent manner, right? Because you don't know a priori what those yellow chromosomes are, right? Because they already contain the admixture of red, right?
Well, the idea is that, okay, so we do know in advance, so suppose we have the HTDP, the idea is that we're looking at individual 1,000 from some population, and we model them as a mosaic of the other individuals. And we know what population each of those other individuals is drawn from.
I'm going to say more or less the same thing. I mean, everybody's mixed, aren't they? Okay. So what's the difference between a pure and a mixed in this?
Well, okay, so the idea is that you're right that everyone is mixed to some degree, okay? But if I take a sample of, you know, there are strong genetic differences between the populations, so they still give information about history. So that if I take an African chromosome, say a Yoruban chromosome from East Africa, then I can pretty reliably assume that, you know, their ancestors have lived in, sorry, West Africa, their ancestors have lived in West Africa for some time in most places in the genome, but not all. And so if I copy from them, it's a somewhat noisy but reasonable, if I copy from them, I can make a reasonable inference that that piece of chromosome probably originates from West Africa, and I'll be wrong some proportion of the time, but I'll still have said something helpful.
But I guess the result is it would work for sort of small admixtures, and presumably as the admixture percentage increases, the whole thing will just start decreasing.
So we have some robustness in that the copying procedure itself will try and select the right DNA to copy from. So if one of these populations that we're putting in is in fact heavily admixed, but and in fact we're only related to one of the populations in the admixture event, we'll tend to selectively copy the haplotypes from that component of the ancestry and ignore the rest. So we'll see some, you know, that will have some effect on this parameter, but there will be at least some robustness to admixture of the source populations. And so the next comment is that what we're going to be interested in doing is inferring admixture in this individual. And it turns out that if these populations that you're drawing from are themselves admixed, there's no actual reason to believe that will lead you to false positive inference of admixture if it wasn't there. It could hurt your power to see it somewhat.
So is there a notion that this coalescent history is dominated by a sort of single, perhaps most probable recombination path? Or, you know, you can be in another regime where you have many ways of reassembling these chromosomes from bits and pieces, which comparable in this case you effectively want to sum over them all.
Yeah, so we do some. So the answer is the path is typically very uncertain, and we tend to average over a number of paths. Okay. So, all right, so we got to a point where we're modeling this chromosome as a mixture of some other labeled chromosomes, and the idea is that that creates some picture here, you know, of red and yellow chunks, and the hope is that if we were fortunate enough and someone were to come and tell us the truth about what happened to this chromosome, there's some correlation between the two things. Okay, so we don't assume that this is a perfect painting of a chromosome in terms of the historical events that have given rise to this now admixed chromosome, but we hope that it gives some information about the truth.
Have you built in known facts about the geography of how people have come out of Africa?
No. So we deliberately assume nothing in all of its analysis except the labels. So in fact, we don't assume where the labels came from. We just know that these populations are different from each other.
So can you just tell this procedure could, in principle, give you these labels? Or is that possible?
The labels are just drawn from the population, from the HTTP itself.
In principle, it should be the outcome of this procedure, assumptions. That you would have to...
Well, that might be, I think that might at least be an arguable point, given that it is possible to sample people from all over the globe and you're not forced to throw away information about where you sampled them from.
Doesn't structure tell you that people self-label?
Yeah, yeah. So, as we'll see, actually, you know, we can at least identify which population almost everyone in this sample is from using this approach. So, if you ran the appropriate clustering analysis, you would be able to recover these labels, I think. So I don't think we should get too worried about the labeling procedure. To at least a first approximation, you know, we can recover those population labels somewhat easily. Okay. All right, so we ran this procedure, and there are two things that we can do. The first, as I said, is paint these chromosomes, and we'll talk more about that in a minute. But the second thing we did is we inferred all of these copying parameters for each of our populations. Okay, so we modeled this genome as a mixture of all the other 52 populations, so you get a vector of length 52 and the coefficient sum to 1. And what this plot shows is the result of that labeling, or the results of that process of modeling everyone as a mixture. And along the bottom here, each column represents a different individual, so there are 900 different columns. And each row represents a different population. So to find out how we modeled the mix of this individual from the Mozabite population, what you do is you look up there and you say, well, the biggest contribution was from other Mozabite individuals in the fitted model. There's also a reasonable contribution from West African sub-Saharan populations, Mandenka and Yoruba. Also a good contribution from Middle Eastern populations, Druze, Palestinian, Bedouin, and then much smaller contributions from different places in the world.
Without putting in any geography?
No geography, not allowed geography. So the idea, you know, we really shouldn't let ourselves use geography here, actually.
But do you have in some hidden way sort of these ancestors of these populations, or do you just really assume that the Yoruba genome is your state that you then put in this admixture? So if I look at whatever Druid and figure out how much they have of Yoruba, that's really how much they have of the genome that's out there now.
Yeah, so you actually suggested an approach that would be an intelligent one, I think. That you, one thing you might do is try and guess what the ancestral populations really look like and model everyone as a mix of them.
But you don't do that
We don't do that.
But you don't do that sort of by accident, even by doing this recombination process?
I think to an extent we do that. So the idea is that we use the present-day populations as a surrogate for those ancestral groups. And what you might think of this vertical vector is showing you is a map of the proportion of a genome that you most recently copied from each of those groups. So it says that the biggest chance of you being you have all of these 1,000 individuals, and at any place in the genome, any one of them could be your nearest relative. And this says that most places in the genome, or highest proportion, a Mozabite is your nearest relative. And then if a Mozabite isn't your nearest relative, next most likely is a Mandenka individual, and so on. And so what I wanted to say was that, firstly, you know, this picture here shows some nice features, and they're not totally unexpected features given earlier work. So firstly, that there seem to be several clear different groups, and the only thing that we've done where we did use geography was in labeling these rows, in sort of ordering these rows and columns. Okay. So we use some
big blocks, one in the middle and one on the right.
Yeah, so let's start with this block. This is sub-Saharan African populations. They tend to copy from one another. These guys are Eurasian populations, so Europe, West Asia, Middle East, North Africa. These guys are East Asian populations. These are Melanesians and Papuans, and then we have populations from the Americas. Okay, so those population distinctions have all been seen before and are very clear.
This
here too.
If you had used mitochondrial haplotypes, you might have had an even cleaner split into it, because those are the migrations out of Africa.
Yeah, so this panel is consistent with what's thought to have happened in terms of a single human migration out of Africa, causing this split, and then a Europe-East Asia split, and then further migrations further and further away. I don't think, feel quite strongly, we would not see such a clear picture from mitochondria, because it's one locus. So this is information combined across essentially tens of thousands of independent loci in the genome. So I think that this probably gives us sort of nice clean picture of what's going on. Okay, so notice that these breaks, although they're pretty clear, they're not completely distinct. So that there are some populations, like the Mozabite, you know, largely in this clump here, but shows seemingly a lot of sub-Saharan African copying, and that extends to even some West Asian groups with a more subtle or slight signal of African copying. And if you look at this split, it's not actually a clean split. There's two populations here, the Hazara and Oiga, which we're going to return to, that seem to kind of bridge that divide. So they seem like a pretty even mixture between Western Eurasia and East Asia. And
the limitation of that you have chosen on the axis of the population is the one that gives you the more clear block structure is.
So what we actually did to draw this block structure is we use all of these vectors, and we use that to do a clustering analysis of a population. So we clustered individuals with the most similar, or actually populations with the most similar vectors first, and then we can use that to build a tree of all the populations. And so first rule is that we must respect that tree, and now we can actually pinwheel that, you know, that creates a clustering tree, but we can wheel that around in lots of different ways. So it doesn't uniquely specify an order of populations. So then we went to geography in order to sort of, you know, give a logical presentation of the results. So this is only a presentation of the results. We didn't use any geography in the analysis itself, apart from knowing that this population and this population are different.
Are the Hazaras the descendants of Genghis Khan?
OK, we'll get to that later. So the Hazara are an interesting population because they look like this mixture, but they live somewhat to the west of most of these other Pakistani population sampled by the HGDP. So they're well away from the other East Asian groups, but seem to show this clear East Asian contribution. All right, so the other thing I wanted to say was that let's look at this picture. It's actually it gives us some information, but it's fairly fuzzy in some sense, in that we don't seem to. So if we take, for example, the Mozabite, the Bedouin, and the Palestinians, they all seem to show a similar pattern where they get, you know, qualitatively, they get some contribution from sub-Saharan Africa, and they seem to copy somewhat more of the Mandenkan and Yoruban chromosomes, but it's not clear whether there's a difference between those groups. And it's equally not clear what we'd expect to see if it was one population rather than another one that had contributed to that pattern. Okay, so given that these groups themselves, the Mandenkan and the Yoruba, also share a similar smudging effect, it's not clear what we'd expect to see if this group were, say, a clean mixture of Bedouin and Bantu Kenya. We'd still see some actual smudging of the results. So we'd kind of like to clean the results up. And the last comment I make on this picture is that most of the, you can see this diagonal effect where there's brighter colors. What that corresponds to is an excess of self-copying for each population. And you're only going to see an excess of self-copying for each population if they have some sort of genetic distinctness relative to the others. So it's evidence of either sort of unaccounted for genetic variation in those groups, or quite likely in some cases, genetic drift in those populations since they split from the others. And you know, for almost every population, you see at least some sign of that effect. So there's really a lot of power in this data to see very subtle isolation effects between these quite closely related groups. And some...
Symmetric.
Oh, it's not symmetric because there's 1,000 columns and 53 rows. So I wanted to show... You know, I wanted to show each individual, and some populations have more individuals than others. And I could bunch them up, but I decided not to do that.
Before you move on, so in the East Asians, am I interpreting right that big red line across that? That's the Han making contributions to almost all East Asian populations?
Yeah, which is not a historically surprising thing to happen, I think. So it's known that there's been a big Han expansion, you know, cultural and seemingly genetic, across China.
Vertical stripe as well. I'm not getting the difference between the rows and the columns.
There's not a vertical, so the vertical things sort of correspond to, so a vertical stripe would correspond to how the Han are made up, right? And a horizontal stripe corresponds to how the Han give DNA to the other populations.
Your individuals and your populations are taken from the same data at the same period of time, right? So you're matching individuals to a bunch of data taken from individuals at not millions of years ago, but also today. So how can you tell who is the ancestor and who is the...
So we make an implicit assumption that, or in interpreting these results, I mean, the results are what the results are, but in interpreting the results, we make an implicit assumption, I think, that the ancestors of these populations were not so different to today's populations, at least on the timescales that matter. And that assumption is at least somewhat questionable, I think, but I imagine that this signal of, you know, it's probably true that this Han influx into the other populations is at least within the past 3,000 or 4,000 years. And so there won't have been much time for genetic drift of that population in that time.
Yeah, and you also see, it's weaker, but you also see the Mayas have both a horizontal and a vertical lines. I'm not sure how I would interpret that all across.
Yeah, I don't know about the horizontal line either. They may carry genetic diversity that other populations don't. So it may be that, you know, maybe sort of old relationships between these groups before the Out of Africa event. The vertical line reflects admixture into the Maya, as we'll see. Okay, so generally when you see vertical lines that you don't expect to see, you know, you see these events and these events, for example, that's highly suggestive of some admixture into those groups.
Height of the blocks is proportional to time in some sense, since an event that isolated these blocks.
Yeah, you mean that if we could project out of the plot.
There are two rectangles, right, in the plot, in the middle, the big ones, and.
This one and this one.
Yes, and the vertical distance is somehow a measure of time since some kind of an event. So these people have evidence of mixture of many different populations over a certain period of time. And so would you infer that this is the measure of that time, which is well known, it's about 50,000 years.
How do you mean the vertical?
The size of that block, you know, it's a rectangle, and the height of that rectangle is 50,000 years.
You mean this?
There's more population sample than you're ready for.
Yeah, but my claim is they would all fall in there. you would have, of course, you would expand the scale, but the relative, the fact that the heights are the same in the two, sort of correlates with the fact that the out of Africa events happen.
Correlate means that they sampled equal numbers of East Asian and Eurasian populations.
But not equal numbers of individuals in either way.
Yeah.
I understand. But these individuals, each of them who have an admixture which is geographically related, are carrying the same admixture. Otherwise, the rectangle wouldn't have been.
I see. So, I think I'd make an argument that what really defines how many populations are in the rectangle is probably geographic features. So between these guys and these guys, we have things like the Himalayas and the Urals that are natural geographic barriers to gene flow. And they have probably determined which populations fall into which camp, is my guess. And I really don't have anything. You know, I think it's possible we could use methods like this to say something about such ancient events like out of Africa splits, but I'm concentrating on something that really hasn't been studied very much using this kind of data, which is more recent admixture events in the last few thousand years. So I don't want to comment about out of Africa at all. Okay, so as I said, there's some fuzziness, and I'll show in a minute how we've attempted to reduce that fuzziness in the data and learn something more. Before I do that, I'll just show you a slide which might answer some of the earlier questions about, you know, population labeling. And what this slide shows is what I've attempted to do is I've taken each individual. It's a sort of leave one out analysis. So I've taken one individual, I've imagined I don't know which population they're from, and I fit them, you know, as a mixture of all the other individuals and got some vector, and then I've tried to identify which population they came from by taking their nearest neighbour according to these vectors. So I've got a vector of length 53 that I try and use to define your population of origin, and this is how we do. So here's the truth along the x-axis, and here's the inference along the y-axis, and the red points, for clarity, the red points are cases where we got it right, and the blue points are mislabeled individuals. And so what you can see is that it does surprisingly well. You know, you get 95% of individuals that are accurately labeled to their precise population of origin from all of the 95 available. And the cases where you get it wrong, you don't have to feel too terrible about, because they tend to be from groups that are very geographically near to one another. So what's happening is that some of these populations, these guys are all sampled from Pakistan, are just very genetically similar to one another, and we can't tell them apart. And notice that, as previous authors have recently shown in some nice papers, you know, there's very clean population structure within Europe. And so of all our European individuals, we only mislabel one individual from France as actually coming from Italy. So all the other Europeans are accurately labeled. And, you know, it may be that that isn't wrong in the sense that they may actually draw ancestry from Italy in the recent past. Maybe. Though you wouldn't want to. Yeah. So, whether. What was that?
I just want to know what the dot, dot, dot was.
Okay, so it really is amazing how precise this data is in labeling where people come from.
So here you're taking the entire vector of 53 assignments. To what extent is, on average, the individual's biggest contribution from their own population?
So, typically, it is from their own population, not always. So we can still classify correctly if that's not true. Then if I can find a group. So it looks a bit like this group here, with very few samples, the Tuscans. They tend to have a biggest contribution from France, but we still label them correctly. And that's just because we didn't sample very many Tuscans, so that reduces your chance of copying a Tuscan individual more recently. Okay. And so we actually want to have an analysis that accounts for that idea too. All right, so the next thing that we thought about doing was saying, well, when we have these admixture events or populations that are related to one another, we'd really like to see who was related to who more precisely than this picture here, which is something of a wash. And so what we've done is we've said, well, suppose I had a population that were a precise mixture of Palestinian and, let's think of something pretty random, and Bhutti pygmy, then what would I expect to see for their parameters? Well, I'd expect to see a vector that looked like the average of the Mbuti, of the Biaka pygmy vector, and I think it was the Palestinian vector. Okay, and that includes the amount of self-copying that we might see from that population. In addition, there might have been some time since that mixture happened, so we might have a term like this that shows an excess of self-copying. And so we took each of these groups and we tried to fit them as mixtures of the other vectors, if you like. Okay, so we used pretty simple linear model-based stuff with forward-backward selection to try and account for these vectors the best we could in terms of the other vectors to try and unravel these mixture events. And so when we did that, we obviously didn't allow our own population to contribute to that answer because we're not. We're sort of interested in the relationships of populations with their neighbours here. And the hope is that that will clean things up a bit, and I think there's some evidence that it does clean things up a bit because all of the results seem to, by and large, get much closer to the diagonal. Okay, so this is what happens after you do that model fitting, and again, this represents the coefficient from each population, but now we've attempted to fit this population in terms of a mix of these others, so this might in some way reflect their real contribution rather than the smudging caused by historical effects. And I think there's at least some evidence that that helps clear things up, so I wanted to concentrate on this corner of the plot and compare these different populations in the Middle East here, in North Africa, and some in sub-Saharan Africa, and see what their contributions were. So I'll start with the Mozabite population, and they're fit by this procedure as a mixture of different populations, but note that now, instead of this slight wash, only three of the African populations are given any weight. And the populations given the biggest weight by far are Mandenka and Yoruba, and they're here and here. And some small weight is attached to this population of Bantu South African. So they're all Bantu-like populations.
The Mozabites,
I'm sorry, are number 7. Okay, so there we go, that's better. So here's the Mozabite, and each of the thicknesses of those arrows is proportional to the amount of DNA that we modeled as being contributed by each of the groups. And so most of their DNA seems to come from a Middle Eastern direction, and note that we haven't got any samples here, so it may be that those are not quite right. But they get a substantial contribution, about 20% of their genome, from sub-Saharan Africa. And specifically, these populations here in the west of sub-Saharan Africa, and all of their contributions seem pretty consistent with their geographical location. And again, we haven't used geographical location at all in producing this picture. So we seem to have some more precision, it makes some sense. And if I switch to Bedouin, so Bedouin are another population that seem to show influx of DNA from sub-Saharan Africa, well, they get a rather different mix of contributing populations, but again, it makes some geographical sense. So they talk to the mozabytes just as the mozabytes were talking to them, but they also get a contribution from here, from West Asian population, I think the Makrani, and they get a smaller sub-Saharan African, but it's still a clear contribution. And rather than being from West Africa, this comes from the eastern side of Africa, which fits well with historical records. And so there's some evidence that by doing this sort of cleaning up procedure and trying to fit these populations as a mixture, we're really learning a lot more precision about really who, what areas contributed DNA to these groups.
Do you know who the ones are? Do you know the one population?
The one population, I'm sorry, are Bantu Kenya. So these populations here, 2, 3, 4, and 1, are all populations that are thought to be Bantu. So indeed they're labeled Bantu South Africa, Bantu Kenya. These are Yorubans and these are Mandenka, but sampled from different places in Africa. So those populations are actually very similar to each other genetically, but it seems like the method is picking out which is appropriate for which population in a way that makes historical and geographical sense. And similarly, the Mandenka get a contribution from, so firstly they get the biggest contribution from their neighbours, the Yoruba. They also get some contribution from other Bantu groups that are more distant. And they're sort of north, so I guess you could say their super Saharan contribution comes from the Mozabite specifically, which again makes geographical sense. And finally, if we do the Bantu Kenyans, they get almost equal contributions from these roughly equidistant Bantu populations, also get a super Saharan African contribution, but this time it's from the East African group. Or sorry, the Middle Eastern group, these are the Bedouin.
So if you change just the sampling of any given group, if you just like start sampling twice as many individuals from, say, the Bedouin's origin, will that change significantly the detail, like results you give here? I mean, for example, if you got an extra population that you sampled somewhere where there's a gap, then you might expect that this is really going to change your detailed analysis.
So the first point is that what happens if you sample more individuals from the same group? I think the answer to that is we hope that, yeah, we've designed a method to be robust to that by accounting for how much, for what you should look like if you're from that group. But it sounds like something we should test, I think, which we haven't done. So the hope is that we're robust to that at least. And the second point, what happens if you sample someone from somewhere else? I think that might well refine the picture. And in general, I think I will try not to be too hasty in really saying this is the population of origin, but it's likely to be at least geographically near to the true population of origin. And yeah, we're being simplistic, right? The population of origin is not one place. It's probably a region of the Middle East and even North Africa, and we're in some sense trying to average it and get a simplest model that explains the data.
The results look quite symmetric. So if you had the influence of one population, sub-Saharan, on super-Saharan, you have also the other directions. Okay?
Yeah.
So is there some sense in the direction? Or would you just say that there's some influence from one to the other?
So we can learn something about the direction, as we'll see, by studying admixture time. So if we find that there's a good admixture time associated with an event, it suggests a real genetic mixing into the population we're looking at. I would say that the direction, if you looked at the previous slide, this arrow is very, very much thinner than the arrow in the other direction. So we at least believe that there's a lot more gene flow in this direction from the Mandenka and the Yoruba into the Mozabite than the other way around. Not much DNA seems to come back. So I think I might take the point, though, that it's possible that because there are some of these chromosomes up there, it looks like there's a subtle correlate, a small contribution when there isn't. It's possible, but as we'll see, but we can actually date the arrival of this DNA, so I think that it is actually a real flow of Mozambique DNA into this population. Okay. All right, so you know, we can look across that plot and get an idea of which populations have contributed to which other populations, but we've really done at most half of what we should do, because what we haven't looked at is when this admixture event actually happens. So we think that this population is a mixture of these other two, but we haven't said anything really useful yet that we can compare to, say, linguistic or archaeological or written evidence and try and make, learn something about history or put it in context, because to do that we really need to find a date of when it happened. And so the main thing, you know, I think the heart of our approach is to have a method for trying to date the arrival of this DNA into these groups. And we use the same thing as before, this chromosome painting. We also use the idea that I brought up earlier that what happens after an admixture event is, in the first generation, the first few generations, you have these enormous chunks. So your genome is made up of these massive blocks from the original populations. And then as the generations pass, these blocks get smaller and smaller. And so if you can learn about the size of these blocks and you know the genetic map, which we do to a reasonable degree, you can go back and infer the number of generations since admixture. So all we can learn is the number of generations since admixture, then we can make a guess of human generation time to try and put calendar dates on the events. And if we could actually observe the chunks, switch to blue and red, so here's an individual, a segment of chromosome with supposedly ancestry chunks. If we could see these ancestry chunks, then the dating process would actually be fairly straightforward. And that's because in units of genetic distance, we can model this chunk switching process as a simple exponential process. So each chunk has, or the distance between ancestry switches has an exponential distribution with rate lambda. Right.
What's your definition of a chunk?
Okay, so let's define a chunk to be a segment of ancestry that's been passed down unaffected by recombination since the admixture event. So that's slightly different to what you see as the red and yellow coloration, because there can have been a recombination event that just paired a red chunk with another red chunk.
But okay. Operationally, when I give you a bunch of SNP samples with SNPs, you have to infer the chunks.
Right. Right. So let's think of the chunks as the underlying truth that we don't get to see, and then we'll see. And then we have to do some slight bit more work to go from that to the stuff we infer. All right, so there's a good model that's been used by other authors, like Felucia et al. In their structure paper in 2002, I guess, that suggests that we model these chunks as having an exponential distribution where chunks switch at rate lambda, and each time you have a switch, you randomly choose a population to draw another segment of ancestry from. It's a very simple model. Well, that makes some prediction about the correlation structure as we move along the genome. And so we can imagine starting at a point zero here, and let's suppose that the red is population A, so that copies from population A. And then we can work out, we can move along the genome and see which ancestry we copy from as we move along the genome, and then average across many such locations and draw a curve, as this one does, which says, what's the probability that I'm copying population A here, conditional on copying population A over here? And there's a theoretical result that's easy for this probability that says that when you plot that function, you should see an exponential decay curve. Okay, so the probability of copying population A declines from 1, because you have to have the same ancestry nearby, to just a genome-wide average at long distances because you end up being independent. And you get this nice functional form for the curve. And so that's really useful for this purpose because now we could plot the curve. And if it's shallow, the admixture happened recently. If it's very steep, the admixture happened a long time ago. If it's almost totally flat, maybe there wasn't any admixture at all. Okay, so, or the admixture was so long ago, but it's unimportant. And so we have a recipe, if we could see the chunks, for dating these events. We could make this plot, date the events. Sadly, as various people have pointed out, we don't get to see the chunks, we have to infer them. And the inference procedure in practice is actually surprisingly sloppy. So here's our sloppy chromosome painting. This is a Meyer individual, and there's good historical evidence that the Meyer, and you know, we see in our genetic data, the Meyer have been influenced by admixture from Europeans, especially Spanish people, that have arrived since the colonization of the Americas. And so expect that that admixture is historical. It, you know, we sort of know the date, it should be recent, there should be very large chunks. When we look at Meyer individuals, it's somewhat difficult, I think, from that to pick out the segments of Native American and European admixture. And so, you know, these various colors that we painted the chromosome with, but European-like chunks are most likely to be labeled as European or Central South Asian. And we can see that we see this region here that seems to have a lot of copying from those groups. There's this odd pattern where you seem to see switching from one group to another. That's because, you know, for those of you who are not familiar with the technical details, don't worry, but that's because this data arrived unphased and was phased for us. And so I think these are probably phase switch errors that cause the inference to be kind of locally messed up on larger distances. But all in all, you can see that our knowledge of chunks in these two individuals in this pretty large-ish region of chromosome 16 is somewhat fuzzy at best. And so what do we do about that? Well, now we're going to suppose that, yeah, we have the same true underlying ancestry as before, but now we've painted with, you know, we've attempted to paint the chromosome in blue and red, and we've got something that correlates with the truth, which is red, blue, red, blue, red, but has these regions where it got it wrong. So what do we do? Well, we can just do this. We can play the same game as we played before and just try and work out the curve, but now using our labeling instead of the truth. And the really helpful thing is that you can do some theory about this, which I'm not going to do. And what the theory says is that this probability has the same form as before. So in other words, you start off from some value and you have an exponential decay to another value, except that instead of 1 minus p and p, in general you have different terms, a and b. Yeah.
But you do have to assume that your error rate is independent of the length of the chunk.
You mean your...
So I was just wondering whether it would be much more likely to mislabel, like if you have a very short chunk in your previous stop and painting, it's probably wrong with a higher probability than a largest chunk.
Yes, I think that's...
Would that mess up your theory, or is that...
So, I think that's a quite local... So if the chunks are reasonably large, then you're likely to... Each chunk is likely, as you see here, to be made up by lots of different segments. And when you have lots of... As soon as you have more than one segment, you know, the probability of being wrong at a location becomes reasonably constant. I think because we don't use any long-range correlation, to put it a bit more clearly, because we don't use any long-range correlation in making the chunks, we're probably equally likely to be wrong at any point in the genome, reasonably, as long as the chunks are bigger than the underlying chunks have to be bigger than the sort of ancient chunks we infer, which they almost always will be.
You're not looking at chunk size distribution, but at the decay of correlation.
Yes, exactly. So all we need, our Lee and Stevens model could be fairly hopeless in really describing genetic data, but all we need is that our labeling correlates with what's actually going on in some way. So if it gives us some information about what's going on, then we can make inference. As long as we move far, take points that are far enough apart where the local LD structure is not relevant anymore, it's only the admixture process. Yeah.
What happened to mutations? So early on we had this notion of coalescent and there'd be some recombination and then some new mutations would come in certain blocks. Or alternatively, are we already thinking that all this mixing is so recent that there are essentially no mutations in any subpopulations? Because in the mind, I can imagine that there are some mutations that have arisen in that population and I'm not sure that I'm just ignorant of such things.
So there are such things. Firstly, we won't see many of them.
Wouldn't they play some rather special role in they would impose constraints?
So the key point is that we're not dealing here with sequence data. We're dealing with genotype data. So the only things that have been typed in this group for this data set are SNPs that have been identified by sequencing, you know, a small number of individuals from around the world, and they're therefore, because those people are drawn from specific places, those SNPs are likely to be relatively old and not have happened specifically in the Maya. Second point is if instead we had sequence data, which we soon will, for lots of different populations, things like the 1000 Genome Project, we would be able to do a better job of painting than we're doing, I think. And there's evidence, I think Jeff Wall published a paper that suggested that there's actually quite a lot of private variation in these populations, and you really could learn a lot more about ancestry if you had sequence information, but we just don't have it yet. And the third point is that mutation itself shouldn't be a confounder, because it's a factor we allow for in the chromosome painting. Once we've done the painting, we sort of throw away the rest of the data and just use the results.
And if you did have a Maya-specific mutation and a target chip, then your method would account information, and everyone who had that mutation would be forced to
copy the Maya.
Yeah, the Maya at that point.
Yeah, but we just don't expect to see much of that, I think.
But isn't the mutation you allow for potentially parallel mutations in the same allele? In the same allele, it's not.
No, it can be. I would think of it more as that would be true for SNP data, but we could apply the model to sequence data as well, and then I think it would be. I mean, in some way, the mutation model is just like says there's some fuzziness in the copying process. I mean, but.
First of all, the phasing that you do. Do you use grouping first? Do you group them into the known classes first before you do phasing within the class?
So our phasing was done. Graham's laughing because he knows. So we actually bought in phase data from Joe Pickrell in Chicago. He gave us his phase data. So I don't actually know what he did. Graham knows exactly what he did, perhaps.
So we phased the data and we used some of the population. We used the sort of seven big global regions, but we phased it with knowledge that a particular individual belongs to one of those regions, but is not forced to only borrow phase information from that region. So it uses all of the information we have in the data, but is slightly biased, or actually the model sort of slightly tends to use information within that region more.
Okay. But when you find an ambiguity in the phasing, how do you choose that? I mean, is there a cutoff to how accurate the phasing is before you'd accept it, or?
So there's definitely
ambiguity.
There's definitely ambiguity. So what Simon has is the best.
Best, yeah.
Best guess. The maximum likelihood, but you could actually sum over.
You could have many, many different phasing.
Yes, you would have it all. So the phasing that we procedurally applied is a number of different ways, and we used some trio data to assure ourselves that what we're doing is the best possible thing we can, but obviously you can't account for the uncertainty.
Yeah,
and I suspect it doesn't actually matter. But
I mean, to defend why I didn't worry too much about the particulars of a phasing, it's because we go into this thinking the phasing isn't accurate. We'll see phase flips that might mess with our inference, which it seems you seem to see in practice. And so we have to have a method that's robust to errors in phasing. So we only trust the phase. We use the phasing to do the local painting, and that hopes that the at a very local level of tens of kb, hundreds of kb, the phase is accurate enough to be useful, which is almost definitely true. And at longer ranges, we have a procedure for allowing for the idea that the phasing might be wrong. I lost the ability to turn off this pointer. Oh, there it's gone. Good. Okay, so. So I was going to get back to this theoretical result that says that, you know, once you're out of the grasp of local LD, you see this, you have to see this curve for the copying probability. So you see the same form as before, but with different start and end points that are hard to predict. And the point is now, if I plot the corresponding curve, but I just use my painting, I ought to see the same form of decay curve, except to a different start and end point. And I can still use the steepness or the rate of decay or the half-life, whatever you want to call it, of that curve to learn the date of the admixture event. And so that's the useful feature of the method and the property of the chromosome painting that's very helpful. And we do a subtle modification of this, is that we divide this quantity by the sort of genome-wide probability of population A, in order that, in some sense, at long distances, we expect this thing to converge to one. And okay, so here's what we did. I'll tell you which population this is from in a second, but here's some real data from the HGDP that we did this procedure from. So this is one of our populations, and we calculated this curve averaged across chromosomes in individuals. We plot genetic distance against, in this case, the French plot, so it's the probability of copying a French-labeled chromosome here, conditional on copying a French-labeled chromosome here. And what you can see is that it does look like a nice smooth exponential decay with distance. This is real data, and there's some noise, not too much noise.
Is the mean 90 mu, or do you understand?
Yeah, this fella here.
Yeah.
I think that's the effect of local LD. So I left it on to sort of... So at short distances, what happens is, you know, there's short-range correlation between the chunks that you copy, and that can affect the probability that you copy someone from the same population, given that you copied someone else nearby. And that's particularly acute, as it turns out, this population is one with extremely long-range LD because it's an American population, Native American population. And so that means that LD effect seems to last a fairly long way, but you can see that, you know, once it goes away, things seem to satisfy expectations pretty well. We do try and allow for local LD by only comparing pairs of positions where we see a change in these copying blocks. So the hope is that if Lee and Stevens were completely able to model short-range LD, that would remove any such effect. Probably the explanation of it only counting for a very small bump in the curve, but it doesn't seem to completely work. The other important thing to say is that we allow for unphased data by actually averaging this probability. So we condition on the state here, but now we average this probability over both the chromosomes. So the idea is if there's a phase switch between here and here, we ought to be looking at this chromosome, and so we just take the average. It, again, doesn't affect the form of the curve, but should mean we're robust to those nasty phase flips, which would otherwise, you know, really messes up, actually.
So what
how do you think your chunk size compares to the decay rate of your correlation here?
Okay, so let me give you some sense of, yeah, it's a good question. So this is the distance in centimorgans, right? So in the human genome, the average recombination rate is about 1 centimorgan per megabase. So roughly, this distance here corresponds to 10 million bases apart. And so the idea that this is short-range LD is pretty plausible, because it's really unlikely that in many human populations you see a strong LD effect beyond a megabase or a few megabases.
So the chunk size really is like a couple of megabases.
Yeah, so the chunk size is, yeah, half of chunks have are bigger than 12 megabases or something in this case. So it's really big compared to the LD effect in this group. And as we push towards older events, we have more problems, I think. There'd be more argument to be made about whether short-range LD could be a problem. All right. So that curve I showed you was actually the curve for the Maya, or one of the curves for the Maya. And our sort of fitting that population as a mixture of the others suggested that the Maya had a mixture of Native American expressed as Colombian. You know, there are not many Native American populations sampled in the HGDP, so big pinch of salt, I think. European ancestry best modeled as French, which might be a reasonable surrogate for the Spanish and Portuguese, and some African ancestry, and it's unclear whether that African ancestry corresponds to African slaves brought along with the Europeans, or whether it actually corresponds to older African ancestry in their genomes themselves, because they're Spanish. So, and here's the curve I just showed. That's for the French. And what we can do is we take that curve that we see and we fit an exponential decay to it. And this is the best fit curve. And we can not just look at French, we can look at the Native American chunks. And so we get a corresponding plot. Somewhat more noise because the effect size is smaller. So this goes from 1 to 1.03, this goes from 1 to 1.5. So it's because most of the genome of these individuals is Native American, so we don't see as big an inflation locally. But nevertheless, what we do is we force in the likelihood computation to do the curve fitting information to be used from all of these curves jointly, and then we can see that it provides a pretty, you know, this predicts an admixture event 8.3 generations ago, and it's a reasonable fit to the data. And that's not historically insane, because 8.3 generations ago, we've been assuming 28 years per human generation throughout, comes out around 1775, so within the range of times that Europeans are likely to have influenced this population genetically.
Is there a difference between the X and other chromosomes?
We've not looked at the X yet. So I think there are some technical issues with analyzing the X, like working out, you know, the generation time might be different and working out how much recombination there's been. But I think it will be fascinating to see whether things like the admixture proportions differ between the X and the autosomes, but we haven't done it yet.
Can you tell if the African ancestry is born or?
The African ancestry looks somewhat like the. So all of these curves, I'm just trying to reduce the number of curves I show. So, you know, we fit this group as a mixture of 5 or 6 other populations, and it's hard to show a 6x6 plot. So we can do cross plots as well, where you plot Native American versus European. So the African plot actually looks rather similar to these, and positively correlates, I think, with the French plot, which is why I said it's possible that the French, well, the Spanish, brought the African ancestry with them. Okay.
So, but your method in principle cannot distinguish between an indirect contribution to the population in this case with respect to a direct
contribution. So, I mean, the African ancestry could be, as you said, passing through the European one, or directly, and you can include and distinguish.
So I think in principle we could distinguish it. We haven't worked hard enough to do so. So we could look at, if the African ancestry arrived totally independently, I'd expect that there was a negative local correlation between French and African ancestry, and I don't see that. And so that suggests that these ancestries are associated with one another in some way. And that could either be because those, you know, it could be that the Europeans, the Maya that have more European ancestry also have more African ancestry for some reason. Or it could be because the Europeans themselves carry African DNA. Both would give qualitatively, but probably quantitatively, different signals. And I haven't worked at whether we can distinguish those two things. I think it should be possible because these chunks are big. So if I went and looked at the painting, I might be able to discern whether the African chunks were big or small, or whether they were within the European chunks. I mean, in general, this is a really easy case. And in general, it'd be a much harder problem. But this is an easy case because, you know, these are some of the more differentiated human populations that are mixing. The event is new, so the chunks are big. So I think we should be able to tell the answer, but just don't know it.
Just so I'm clear, you're fitting a single lambda for all these correlation plots?
Yeah, we don't have to do that. And actually, so something I'm going to bring up later is that if there are multiple events, you get something of the same form but with different lambdas. So you get a curve that looks like a mixture of exponentials, and we can fit that pretty easily. Now it's a notoriously difficult, it's easy to fit, but it's notoriously difficult to analyze mixtures of exponentials. And the trouble is that you get a curve that kind of decays. You know, it starts off steep and it decays, and what you tend to find is that it's a pretty ill-posed problem in that there are multiple different dates and mixtures that you could use that would all fit the data fairly well. And we have some advantage here that we can look for different effects in different groups and help to separate the dates. But I think I don't want to make very strong claims about being really precise about multiple events. You get some sense that there are multiple events, and we'll see examples of that. But yeah, I feel nervy about really solidly dating them. Okay, so here's a really easy case where the admixture was, you know, very historically well attested. But we also found some more interesting or harder cases. As well, we found that, as someone earlier said, everyone is admixed, at least with... If you use a loose enough definition of admixture, there is a signal of admixture in every population. But in many cases, particularly Europe, that admixture is between the very local groups that you're nearest, so it's questionable about... The question is whether you want to think about it as admixture or just movements and migrations of people by chance over a long time. On the other hand, there are some very striking and clear, you know, long-distance movements of lots of people at very specific times. And these admixture events, you know, affected the whole world, and I'll try and show a few examples from these different places so that we can see that they really do affect the whole world. And obviously there are lots of interesting admixture events I'm just not going to mention. All right, so first thing I want to show is that it doesn't always look like the Maya. So here's the Hazara that someone really helpfully mentioned earlier. The Hazara live way out over here in the western part of Pakistan. And we modeled them as a mixture of a number of populations, but I'm just going to show two that are representative of the event. The Pathan, there's this loopy curve here. They're right next door to the Hazara geographically. And the Orokin, who are from thousands of miles away, and they're right next to the Mongols geographically. So here's Mongola there, and here's Orokin. And the Orokin are rather similar to the Mongola population genetically. And we see this result here. You know, that's about the best fit to an exponential decay curve we get anywhere in the data. And it's a steeper curve than before, and it pins the admixture event at 22.2 generations. Go take that number with some pinch of salt. But that dates to 1385, which is around the end of the Mongol Empire. So I think the result is that the Hazara descended from Genghis Khan. No, that's a yes, absolutely. So there's Y chromosome evidence that says that 30% of them have the Y chromosome of Genghis Khan. We'd expect the autosomal contribution, in seriousness, we'd expect the autosomal contribution from Genghis Khan to be much, much smaller than that, maybe a few percent. But on the other hand, what we do see is that they seem to be descended, or, you know, descended is the wrong word. Half of their genome seems to come from somewhere near Mongolia, perhaps soldiers or immigrants from that region have brought it during the Mongol Empire, and they've mixed with the local population since. And it just, you know, it seems like a very clear event. It's about a 50-50 mix. And another population that are rather genetically similar to the Uyghur in terms of their makeup, sorry, to the Hazara, in terms of their makeup, are the Uyghur. And the Uyghur live here, still quite a long way from Mongolia, and we fit these guys as a mixture between the Pathan, which are the same population as moved into the Hazara, and the Zebo. And the Zebo are, again, right next door to where the Uyghur live. And that admixture event is dated at almost exactly the same time, and we see almost exactly the same curve. Now, it's unclear to me whether or not this means that the Uyghur are created by a different event in some sense to the Hazara, because the Zebo are known to have migrated historically from East China. So we can't assume that where these guys live now is indicative of where they lived then. So I think that I would, you know, back away from saying they're different events at the same time or some strong thing such as that. But both these populations show a clear signal of admixture during the era of the Mongol Empire. And that's a theme that we actually see in lots of different populations, as it turns out. So here's the Mongol Empire. You can see it covers lots of China, West Asia, Siberia, Mongolia, obviously, that was started by Genghis Khan and then carried on for several centuries, mainly by his descendants. And 8 of the HGDP populations within this empire show an admixture event that dates to within, or close to within, the era of the Mongol Empire itself. And so here they are. So here's the Uyghur and Hazara. But also the Mongols themselves and their neighbor populations also show an admixture event slightly earlier, though whether those dates are significantly different is questionable. But interestingly, they seem to show an influx of DNA from the other direction, so suggesting that they maybe opened up routes for immigration or migration. So they've got DNA that's flown back in that direction, and they all date around the same time. This is the two, and then, you know, we see an event around the same time, even as far west as the far reaches of the empire, which was Adigai, drawn from Turkey. So the Adigai show an influx of DNA more locally, and so it's unclear whether that's facilitated by the presence of the empire or not. But, you know, the biggest clustering of dates in the whole data set, I think, is represented by this Mongol era event. And it's known to have been one of the most sort of impactive movements of humans. Graham doesn't like the word impactive, I think. But it's known to have been, you know, a really huge event in terms of moving large numbers of people long distances and having a huge effect on reducing the numbers of whole populations around throughout the whole empire. So the fact that we see a genetic signature of it is perhaps not surprising. Okay, so earlier I showed you the picture of the Mozabites getting seemingly DNA from West African sub-Saharan populations, and I guess that's probably a sign we should break for coffee soon. So let's do this example first and then do that. And so the Mozabites show a rather complicated event between West Sub-Saharan Africa and the Middle East or Southeast Europe. So again, here's a representative pair of populations, the Bedouin and Mandenka, and they both show this curve here, but here's a new curve, they're in opposition to one another. Okay, so if you see Bedouin here, you're less likely to see Mandenka nearby, and these are just symmetric. And visually, it looks as though, in some sense, it's steep and then shallows off a bit. There's somehow a kink in the curve. And you can see that when we fit a single exponential decay, yeah, it looks like a fairly poor visual fit. It doesn't start steeply enough. And this suggests that the Mozabite have probably been influenced by admixture more than one time in history. And so I went ahead and fit the two admixture event model with all the caveats that I stated before about being careful about how seriously we take the event's dates that it produces. But it gave two dates of 38 BC, so 2,000 years ago, reflecting this very steep part of the curve, and much more recently. And I think that what I'd say about this is that the genetics of this population seem to support the idea that they've been admixing with individuals from sub-Saharan Africa for a long time. And it's at least, you know, given that this steepness, it's probably at least 2,000 years that they've been these people in North Africa. Let me see. So 5 parameters being this 2 dates. Yeah. Well, there are two decay parameters, but I think my comment would be that there are probably other pairs of decay parameters that can almost fit these curves, so that we should be a bit careful about how seriously we take these things.
So what would happen if you assume that there weren't events, that there was just a constant rate of mixing all the time?
Then we could, I'm sure we could, yeah, you still want to have some start and end point, I guess, for the mixing.
Well, can't you just let that mix?
There's still a parameter in the... I mean, there's still a parameter in the model. There's some parameters that you need to have. I'm a bit worried about the fact that would be a very specific assumption about...
Well, it would be the opposite extreme to one event.
Yeah. Yeah, I see.
But you need, as a working hypothesis, distinct populations, right? So if you allow for concurrent mixing, then that doesn't make sense anymore to call it distinct.
Well, I mean, it depends on what the proportion is that they're coming in with. I mean, if it's only given 1% of the chromosomes, then you could still consider the copying process as being something between the same population.
How would the patchwork look like if you would have constant influx, like the chunks?
So you get something which is...
A bit like this, maybe.
Well, it's a sort of 2 exponentials, because time first migration event is exponentially distributed, and then you have an exponential decay of the chunk around that migration event.
Okay. I mean, I think it's an interesting idea, actually, to simulate. Suppose you had a constant influx. I think, again, you'd still be a bit worried about making very firm statements about what happened. I think even if you could see... So we've actually done some work where we tried to identify the chunks in Mozabite, because it seems like a relatively clean event between this population and the Mandenka. And that reveals a chunk structure across the genome. Even with that chunk structure in hand, it's going to be pretty hard to say exactly what went on, because you see lots of very small chunks. You know, you see some that are 10 or 20 megabases. You see one individual in the sample who looks like a first generation admixture, and various different scenarios would be equally compatible with that observation, I think. So I think there must be a limit to what you could say, but and perhaps you just want to say they've been mixing for a long time. Okay, and oh, I said that we'd go for coffee then. So I was going to describe a few more admixture events, and I'll try and go through those reasonably quickly so we can talk at least some about the disease mapping application as well. So another event that we see that's of some historical interest is that in the Melanesian population, the Melanesian population is, if you think of like Southeast Asia, and then you go a little way and you get Papua New Guinea, and then to the east and south of that is where they sampled these Melanesian individuals. So they're not as far out as Polynesia, but they're sort of a long way from the mainland. These Melanesian individuals show evidence of an admixture event, and here are the curves, and the contributing populations. Our best model for them were that there were a bunch of different East Asian populations. For example, the Xi from Southeast China, and nearly all the contributing populations were from the far south of Asia. And they seem to have admixed with a population most closely related to that of Papua New Guinea, and perhaps representing an ancestral group in Papua New Guinea and Melanesia. And we get a date of 838 AD. So the first millennium AD. And again, I think there's a fairly clear curve. You know, we're moving slowly to the left towards where we may be worried about the effect of local LD. But there is some sign of a little kink here that might reassure us slightly that local LD is not disastrous. And our signal is still coming from distances that are of the order of millions of bases in the main. So there's still some signal visible here at 3 or 4 megabases away. And this is of interest because it's thought from things like pottery evidence that there have been multiple waves of human migration into Melanesia, probably originating from the mainland. It's been suggested Taiwan specifically. A number of these populations are near to Taiwan, who we haven't got any samples from. And so what's happened is that these individuals have brought some new culture in from the mainland. They passed through Papua New Guinea on the way, and then they arrived in Melanesia and populated it. And so we see some evidence that may be the case, because we see this admixture event whereby there may have been some genetic mixing with the Papuans on the way through to Melanesia. And we get a date for that probable later wave of colonization of 800 AD, for what it's worth. And that's not, I think that's a little late than some of the archaeological evidence, but it's not sort of crazy.
How does population expansion affect all the dates? Does it make them all earlier?
You mean if there's been a population expansion since the admixture event?
Yeah.
Hopefully it shouldn't affect it may affect the properties of our estimation procedure, because it affects how independent different individuals are. Shouldn't put a bias on the estimation, because we're basically randomizing one individual in turn, then averaging across individuals, hoping that their ancestry chunks are independent of each other, which they should be if the effective population size isn't really small. But if there's violation of that assumption, you know, we'll probably see more noise and variance in our estimate. We shouldn't see a systematic bias. In principle, we could analyze one individual and get the right date if they were informative enough. Okay, and lastly, I just wanted to give a couple of examples from sub-Saharan Africa, because I haven't talked about any admixture events from there. And so, again, earlier I showed this slide where I said that suggested that the Bantu Kenyans had received DNA and it mapped to the Middle East area. And when we analyze that event, here are the typical curves, we get a date of about 1100 or 1000 AD. And the admixture seems to be between a Bantu population and a Bedouin or a Palestinian related group. And again, you know, so the idea is that we take the genetic information and then we try and add it to what's known. So this is what the genetic information says, and that chimes in pretty well with archaeological and written records of North Africa, which suggests that for a long time along the East African coast, there's been the presence of North African, Middle Eastern, West Asian, and also Indian individuals who even founded towns and ports all along that East coast. And then at some point in history, the Bantu expansion occurred and a Bantu language appears in Kenya. It's been dated to around 1000 AD, which is, you know, conveniently close to the close to this date. So it's unclear whether or not, you know, we see that there's this North African or Middle Eastern DNA in these Bantu Kenyan individuals. It's unclear whether the admixture was facilitated by the arrival of Bantus or the arrival of, you know, whether the Bantus arrived first or the Middle Eastern individuals arrived first, but certainly we see a mixing event that dates to that time. And if we think of that as an example or related to the Bantu expansion, we see a different Bantu expansion event in South Africa, whereby it's thought that in South Africa, the sort of the original peoples or the peoples that were there several thousand years ago were Khoi and San peoples. And according to archaeological and linguistic evidence, they're supposed to have been displaced by arriving Bantu individuals with more modern technologies. And it's unclear when that actually occurred, but we see a genetic signature of exactly such an event, admixture between Bantu-like populations, including the Yoruba and the San. We haven't got any Khoi individuals. It's hard to find Khoi individuals in the world now. They're largely extinct people. And it's a very clear signal, and we date it at about 1000 AD, which is somewhat close to the Kenyan date way over on East Africa as well. So we think that these, you know, at least this event and perhaps the other event are actually genetic signals of the Bantu expansion around Africa that occurred, you know, really from many thousands of several thousand years ago up until around 1000 AD. That's when it's sort of attested to have finished. Okay, so to conclude, what we found was that, you know, that firstly the approach seems to work in that we see these curves with various different decay rates that really, according to theory, should only be produced in the presence of admixture. And we found such, you know, we were able to find a date for all of the populations in the HGDP. And I've concentrated on the more recent things because I think you might worry about local LD for very ancient events. And however, we did get dates for events. The oldest was Yoruba at 2800 BC. So the events date between then and right up to the present. And a number of themes that we highlighted that seem to explain many of the admixture events that we see in the data. You know, across Asia, the Mongol Empire seems to be when things are happening. Sub-Saharan Africa, we see a lot of events that could relate to the known Bantu expansion. And then we also see a lot of events that associate with the movement of sub-Saharan Africans to various different places in the world, you know, we've seen the Americas and North Africa, but also to some of those Middle Eastern populations. And that's probably occurred through both the European and the Arab slave trades in historical times. And, you know, there are probably major cause of those admixture events, but also some local migration, particularly to North Africa, is probably also a factor. And lastly, in places like Europe, there's evidence that there's sort of not big influxes of people, but extensive local mixing, whereby we see some admixture between really adjacent populations. I haven't concentrated on those findings because those signals are typically very weak, and I think they're somewhat tentative results. Okay, so for the last 25 minutes, I'm going to switch to a different topic, which is association mapping. Okay, and I think I'll try and be easier on us all by skipping some of the really technical details and giving you a flavour of what the idea is about. And a lot of you have probably heard of, so the aim here is that we've got some common disease, and I'm going to give the example of prostate cancer. So pretty common disease, especially in older men. It affects humans, and we want to find genes that influence our risk of getting that disease. And many of you have probably heard of the approach, it's called disease mapping using admixture LD, or MALDs, mapping by admixture linkage disequilibrium. And just to remind you, the idea of this approach is to say, well, ancestry itself might be useful in mapping disease variants. So suppose that I've got some disease of interest, and you know, we don't know this in advance, but there's some real disease locus, and it's right here in the genome. Here's our disease locus. Now suppose that we take an admixed population, and what's often used for these studies is African Americans. They're a mixture of West African and European DNA. So what we'll see is that this disease locus, often it will have at least some difference in frequency between those populations. So, you know, maybe it's close frequency between the populations, but maybe it's an allele that's 80% in the African population, 20% in Europe. Then if that mutation affects your risk of getting disease, and you look in a load of cases, your cases will oversample the risk allele relative to the population at large. And by oversampling the risk allele, they'll automatically oversample the population where that cause allele is more frequent at the disease locus location. So at this location, you'll tend to sample a disease mutation, and that comes along typically with sampling ancestry from the population it's more common in. And that effect is relatively local because the genome is made up of these chunks. So it's only at the disease locus that you do this oversampling, and you'll see a decay. So you see an enrichment for a certain ancestry at the disease locus, and as you move away from that disease locus, the average ancestry will return to what's typical for the genome as a whole.
The two parental populations have to differ in the frequency of disease, or at least the frequency of the causal allele?
That's a prerequisite. And typically people have targeted diseases where they see a very different prevalence in African Americans to Europeans, or to European Americans, for example.
There's another assumption that this disease is caused by a few loci, right? Because it could be that there are compensating loci in different populations that you would not find using this.
I think the assumption is, to some degree that's true, but I think the assumption, you could have multiple independent loci. The assumption is that they all have a large enough marginal effect for you to see this effect in a large enough sample. Okay, so there's a sort of interesting, you know, there's an interesting feature of this mapping technique that's sort of important, and it's that we could map this disease. So here we've got patients in the slightly darker line and controls in the grey line, right? The controls just show no difference in ancestry across the whole chromosome, but the cases show a similar feature, and then they have this peak. Well, we could have mapped the allele without using the controls at all here. So what we're essentially doing is we're using their average genome-wide ancestry as a surrogate control. So we use the rest of their genome to control what we think the ancestry should be, and then we look for something odd in their genome. And that's actually important in terms of your ability to map these things, because it means that you lose this source of variation that comes from the controls. Okay, so you can get more power to map variants like this by looking at ancestry, because you don't have that half of the randomness that would come from comparing to your controls. I mean, you'd be crazy not to at least look at your controls to check there wasn't some systematic effect, but you don't formally need them. And this approach has been used, and it has been used to map variants. We'll see an example of one. And the reason it's being used so widely is, I think, for economical reasons. These ancestry chunks in African Americans are quite large because they're admixtures within the last seven generations. And that means that with 20,000 markers per genome, it turns out you can gain lots of this ancestry information and do the mapping. So it's cheap. And so you might think, well, is this mapping by, you know, is the use of admixture LD dead in the sense of, well, now we can type a million SNPs and it's just as cheap as these 20,000 that we have to pick carefully. So there's been a movement towards mapping disease variants using association. And in association mapping, you know, most of the studies that have been published so far have been done in European related populations from Europe and America mainly. And that association mapping just takes your SNP position, gets a load of cases and controls, and looks for differences in the frequency of a SNP. And if you see a difference, the idea is that it's related to the disease. And, you know, there are all sorts of complications, but that's the very simple basic idea. So the question is, when you have a million SNPs and you can test these SNPs directly in this association framework, is there any point in using an admixed population which you were using to save money? And the answer, as I'll show on the next slide, turns out to be yes. And the fundamental idea is that even if you're doing association mapping of a SNP that you're interested in, well, if it's at least partly different between Africa and Europe, say, if you're looking at African Americans, there's both an association signal like this one, which you can imagine as being the difference of allele frequencies conditional on your ancestry, encasing controls, but there's still this admixture signal lurking in the data. So there's still this boost in ancestry locally, and that can help you because that part of a signal is case only. So you don't need to worry about your controls for that part of a signal. You've lost some of the uncertainty in the data, and that results in a boost in power. The cost is, to get that boost in power, you need to be able to identify the ancestry chunks along the genome. And you want to identify those ancestry chunks using these, you know, using this very dense data, which should give very good information about those chunks, we hope. And we can be a bit more quantitative about this idea that it boosts power. So what I've plotted here is, suppose that we have a disease SNP, and it doesn't really matter what its relative risk is, but let's say it increases your chance of getting disease by 1.5 per copy. That disease SNP has some frequency in Africa and Europe. So here's the frequency in Africa versus the frequency in Europe. And we could choose to try and map that variant. I mean, we don't know where it is in advance, but we can choose to do a disease map study in either African Americans or in Europe, say. And the question is, which should we pick to maximize our power of finding this variant that's out there? And what this curve shows is, as a function of those allele frequencies, it shows the relative efficiency of mapping in Africa versus Europe. So yellow and white areas are regions where you do better mapping in African Americans, and red regions are those where you do better mapping in Europe. And so what it means formally here is that at this point with 2 on a scale, you sort of only need 1,000 African-American casein controls to get the same power as if you sampled twice as many individuals in Europe. So there's, you know, you can save half your money at this point in the frequency spectrum. And the sort of take-home message is that there's more yellow and white area in the plot than there is red. So if you sample a typical allele drawn from this region, you'll on average see somewhat of a boost in power by choosing African Americans versus Europeans. And what's likely to happen in practice is that you've already done a scan, say, in Europe, and you're thinking what to do next. Well, efficiently, you might choose to map in African Americans because, you know, there are all these alleles around here that you wouldn't have seen that you might see by looking at a new population. So there's an argument I'm making that you can see a lot more disease alleles in humans by, you know, looking in diverse populations. And further, if you pick an admixed population, the reason more than half of this curve is yellow rather than red is that that admixture information allows you to get an extra boost of power, so increases the area that's yellow or white. All right. So the advantage is biggest when it's highly differentiated between the populations for that reason. Okay, so there's something to be gained by mapping in these groups, but you have to infer the ancestry chunks to gain all the power that's in the data. And there are no existing approaches to do this, so this part of the talk is work with Alkus Price, David Wright, Nick Patterson, R.T. Tandon and others, where we've developed an approach to find these chunks. Now, I know I was telling you earlier that the chunks are really hard to find, and that's true in general, but the benefit of populations like these is that really it's a very much easier problem.
It's the same, finding chunks is what you were talking about before, so why is it getting different or difficult?
So before, what we did is we took this sloppy painting and we used that to learn about the history. That's good when the event is very complicated and you have no good model for the contributing populations and the event was old, so the chunks are small anyway. In this case, so there we have poor information about what the chunks actually are, but we sort of use it anyway. Here, what we need to do is find out very precisely what the chunks are, and there's hope because the admixture happened recently, so the chunks are many tens of millions of bases long. So we can add information across locations, and also because the populations that contributed are actually very well surveyed, or good surrogates of the populations that contributed are well surveyed genetically by the HapMap. So that Yoruba, who were sampled in the HapMap, and the Sefs from Utah, who were sampled by the HapMap, are actually excellent surrogates for the populations that really contributed to this admixture event. That makes things much easier. And we can tell that there are ways of telling that they're excellent surrogates. And the idea of what we do is we take this sloppy painting as we had before. So here's the sloppy painting of earlier. And what it shows is that you see some, here's the true ancestry here, red and blue. But you see some blue chunks in the red and you'd see some red chunks in the blue if you went further. And we actually have now an explicit model where we say some fraction of the time when you're actually in a red chunk, you accidentally copy from a blue chunk, and vice versa. And you can infer those numbers from the data. So what you can do is you take this sloppy painting and you clean it up. Okay? And you clean it up using a fully model-based approach, which has an HMM. And we can also do something else, which is that while we're at this chromosome painting, we can impute SNPs that weren't typed. So we've got data here where there's a SNP that we chose not to genotype or we didn't get information from. What we can do is do this painting before, and now we say we copied from this haplotype here. What we're going to do is we're going to fill in. It's very likely that this SNP here is the same one as that one. So we fill it in, and that enables us to test a lot of SNPs for association, even those that we didn't type. And that's in an admixed population. And that approach is actually very similar to one that was published last year by Jonathan Marchini and others, which looks at just a single, imputing SNPs when you have a single underlying population. So this is an extension of that. It's very natural to admix population. Okay, and it's all, the word here is probabilistically, everything is probabilistic. So we have measures of uncertainty about how likely each SNP is to be, each type, that depends on how much we know about the painting, and about how good our ancestry estimates are. Right, so I'll jump to how it does in simulation. So we simulated multiple, but here's just one African-American like genome. So we have made an average 80% African, 20% European, and admix them for 7 generations under our model. We use real data to mix up, so it's realistic data. And then we tried to guess what the underlying ancestry was. And as you can see, you know, the imputation does extremely well. And the imputed ancestry is almost identical to the truth in this case. If you calculate the correlation between the two things, it's over 98%.
Data generated with the same model isn't the issue with the given model?
It wasn't generated. So what I did is I took some real European chromosomes and some real African chromosomes from real individuals, and then I mixed them up. So the variation is not simulated, but the chunks and the admixture is simulated. So it's as close as I think I can come to simulating real data.
Does the model assume that linkage between contiguous SNPs is higher than linkage between non-contiguous SNPs?
Yes.
Because
yeah,
that's
absolutely.
Not necessarily reflected in the real data. There are known association mappings of which are related to, let's say, P53 MDM2 pathway, where it's known that the MDM2 locus which got selected does not have the haplotype structure which follows this. Anyway, that's in detail.
I mean, there may be issues with all models are wrong, and the idea Leon Stevens has been shown to be.
No, what I'm saying is there could be a complex selection of haplotype associated with a given phenotype. It could be that there are, it's not just one SNP or two SNPs, which is the implicit assumption every time we do these associations, but that whole pathways are involved, and the haplotypes that are evolving are fine, you know, as long as you don't have an unfortunate sequence of SNPs at a whole bunch of loci, which change the pathway in a weird way that causes the disease, and that You might miss the big picture for looking at single SNPs.
I mean, I think I'd say to that that we are looking for marginal effects, but I'll show an example where we are able to find multiple different variants in the same region.
I mean, nobody has a method to.
No, nobody has. But sometimes when you look in global things, you don't see something which, if you look at the pathway, you might see. If you know the pathway, so there are many people who know the disease-associated pathway, and they. And that's people who don't like this whole genome-wide approach. And they say you should look at only the SNPs in the pathway that's known to be associated with disease.
We could discuss that later.
If you have a particular pathway that's of interest, a particular set of genes that are of interest, you can go back and look at those genes in the model scan. There's nothing to stop you.
But many of the SNPs that are known to be in pathways are not found in many of these genome-wide SNP data sets. They just don't exist because they weren't picked. And
but
so you
that's
don't.
That's the point of the imputation.
Yes, I know, but that's why I asked the question about haplotypes, that he assumes that the haplotypes are sequential. And that the association is, that the linkage is between sequential SNPs is higher than linkage between SNPs that are far away from each other. But that's not really true.
The model doesn't actually assume that. The model can also generate patterns where the LD is higher between.
Okay.
Yeah, it's highly stochastic what realization you actually get. And so to give a sense, you know, really we're thinking in lots of data sets there are only 500,000 SNPs typed, and the imputation will impute all the SNPs typed in HapMap, which brings you up from 500,000 to 4 million SNPs. And that's 4 million SNPs is 30% of all the high frequency SNPs in the genome, roughly. So you do you know, it's really worth doing the imputation. Once you do it, all the simulations show that, or simulations based on real data show that you're very likely to capture common variance with high LD. So you won't lose much power just because you didn't type things. Okay, so we use a Bayesian approach to mapping. It's very natural in this setting because it allows us to integrate out our uncertainty. I won't describe the process in any detail, but please ask me afterwards if you're interested. We applied the approach to simulated data, and the upshot is, if there's nothing in it, we simulated data with nothing interesting in the genome. If there's nothing interesting in the genome, you hope to see, you expect to see a Bayes factor of 1, and that's exactly what we saw. So we were just testing whether our method was likely to infer false positives, and it checked out just fine in simulations. When we took real African Americans and we looked for whether or not there was one of these peaks of ancestry anywhere in the genome, we didn't find anything. So in real data, the method doesn't find a host of false positives. And I'd rather just spend the last few minutes talking about the application of a method that's sort of interesting. So we studied a region of chromosome 8 called 8q24, where two previous studies had suggested there was a locus for prostate cancer. So firstly, there was an association study in Europeans by the DECODE group, and that found two different variants that were sort of co-associated with disease status, well replicated, definitely true, these associations in Europeans. And separately, an admixture mapping effort that just looked for this peak in ancestry found a signal in African Americans that also mapped to 8q24. So the obvious question is, you know, that we might try and answer is, are the same variants responsible? We need to try and find map the signal in order to ask that question, or are there additional variants? And so an association mapping study covering this region was performed in African Americans. And we analyzed the data with our method, and so here's the whole region that was studied. And what I'm plotting against position is the Bayes factor we found for each of the SNPs. And happily for our approach, you know, there's a screaming great big signal. We think there's a real signal, so this is good. With a Bayes factor of over 10 million, which will be genome-wide significant. So we're sure that there's, even if we typed the whole genome, we'd be certain there was a disease locus in this region. And if we zoom in on the region where we see these high signals a bit more, something interesting happens, and that is that in African Americans, we see this association signal over here, and these black lines denote LD blocks, and it's very tall, and there's a completely separate but similarly large signal over here, suggesting independent variants are at work. And even within these regions, we find that many of these SNPs are in really low LD with each other, so it suggests further independence of the signals even within LD blocks. And this is the evidence that we saw in the African Americans. And what I've circled in red are SNPs that have since been replicated as independently associated in multiple different populations. So this data was part of a larger study of multiple populations, you know, including Japanese Americans, European Americans, and many others. And the main conclusion is that when you do that wider study, you get results that essentially replicate many of the SNPs that were found here, and also replicate the idea that there are these independent associations. And what's encouraging for the method and for this population as a whole in terms of mapping is that it sees at least some signal at almost all of the real things. And the only signal that looks very weak in our data is a decode SNPs. So they're real, well replicated in Europe, but don't contribute very much to the signal of association in African Americans. So there are different variants at work in this region, and it's a fascinating region. The MYC gene is somewhere down there, but this is sort of several megabases long. And so it looks like, you know, multiple independent variants all associated with prostate cancer, this variant associated with breast cancer as well. Some of the others don't show association with other cancers. So, you know, it's a fascinating region of disease. And since I first prepared this slide, there was a publication in Journal of Cancer and Epidemiology and Biology, bioinformatics, probably biology, by Salinas et al. That suggested that a SNP right here was also replicated and associated with prostate cancer, and it's encouraging that we saw a signal there as well. And it may be that even further afield, there are more SNPs that are going to replicate for this disease. So I've run out of time, so I'll stop there and just thank all the many people at the Broad and in Oxford and in Cork that have contributed to the work. Thank you.